It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Updated guidance from the American Academy of Pediatrics advises parents not to spank, yell at, or shame children, citing research that corporal punishment has been linked to negative outcomes. We're going to have a conversation with a childhood development specialist about what this kind of discipline does to children's health and consider some positive strategies for effective discipline. Do you spank your children or not? We want to hear from you about your thoughts on corporal punishment and parenting. Have you spanked your children before but then stopped? What led you to make the choice and how have things gone since then? Were you spanked as a child? Did you end up spanking your own children, or did spanking in your childhood keep you from doing it as a parent now? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, email address ideas@WPR.org. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Amy Wagner is the executive director of the UW Child Development Lab. Amy, welcome to the Morning Show.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
How is this updated stance on corporal punishment different from the way the American Academy of Pediatrics has treated this particular thing in the past?
Sure. In the 1998 guidelines, the American Academy of Pediatrics basically left it more open-ended in terms of what was considered corporal punishment. So things like spanking, where you don't leave a mark, those types of behaviors, because there wasn't the research base that we have now that really provides the evidence for the new updated guidelines.
And what was your reaction to the update?
A relief, frankly. I felt like for those of us who work with kids on a regular basis, we really see the effects of what this kind of negative behavior can do to children on a long-term basis. But to actually have the evidence and then to have the support of the American Academy of Pediatrics basically making a statement to parents all over America saying, okay, the evidence is in, the research has spoken, we're no longer going to leave it open-ended. We're basically taking a stance on this, saying these parental behaviors, these behaviors by adults who care for young children are not in the best interest of young children and are actually shown to not lead to the positive outcomes that we're really working so hard to foster in our young kids.
Do we have a sense of how common spanking is in terms of child discipline?
It's a really good question. I am not aware of any survey data on parents who have been asking this question, but over the years, what the data has shown is that parents' acceptance of the use of spanking, for example, as an appropriate method has decreased over time, even across different cultures in the country, basically saying the newer generations of parents are less open and accepting to using spanking as an option than it was in the past. And so I feel like it is overall decreasing.
Well, the most recent polling that we've seen, actually, there's really not much there that's more recent than, say, about 2013. There was a Harris poll that found 67% of parents said they had spanked their children, 33% had not. But that was a decrease of about 20% from a 1995 survey. So the trend is certainly downward in terms of spanking. It's not really socially acceptable in 2018 to hit people generally. So why is spanking such a common form of punishment? Why is it more permissible to hit our kids than to hit each other?
That's a really good question. I feel like part of it is that if you were spanked as a child and you feel like you turned out okay, you can often use that logic to say, well, I was spanked and everything is fine with me and it worked for me, so I'm going to do this with my children. Often what we do with our children, we automatically do what our parents have done with us without really taking a step back and thinking about, perhaps I want to make a different decision about this, or perhaps there's more research out there now that tells us that we should be making a different decision about this than our parents did. And so I think that's part of it, is that people automatically sometimes default to the way they were raised. And so that can lead to these behaviors kind of continuing to go on and on.
Well, we learn how to parent from our parents, don't we?
Absolutely. Okay. We absolutely learn from our parents.
And the fact that we use the term spanking rather than, I mean, this is, let's call it what it is, it's hitting. So why do we say, I mean, is this just a semantic thing that spanking makes it more acceptable?
This is a really good question. As part of my work at the University of Wisconsin Child Development Lab, we have to go through mandated reporter training, and I just did my training for child abuse. I just did my training online last week, and I was like, wow, there are a lot of distinctions between what is considered abuse and what is not. And so at this point, the definition of abuse is if you hit a child and you leave a mark. So the difference is basically, is there a mark on the child's body or not? And that to me is scary that we're having to make that distinction. And so I feel like part of it is semantics. So what is corporal punishment versus spanking versus physical abuse? And I think those distinctions, we're realizing the fine line, there's a lot of gray area there, and there's a fine line between those things. I feel like part of it is that parents feel like if you've lost control, it's abuse, and if you feel like you're in control, it's not abuse. But that's not necessarily the accepted definition across the board. So, and I feel like different organizations even reported in the AAP updated guidelines, there are different organizations in the country who define things in different ways. So, for example, in my training last week, verbal abuse was not considered a form of abuse that I'm required to report. However, verbal abuse, as reported here in the AAP guidelines, is actually associated with negative mental health outcomes later on in life and more behavior where you're not following the parent's positive directions later on. And so I think what we're seeing is different definitions from different groups, and that these the area is really gray in between them, and I think that is worth noting.
And we have a caller. Let's go to Kale in La Crosse. Kale, good morning. Welcome to the morning show.
Good morning.
Yeah, go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I was just curious how long the studies were when you made the statement the evidence is in, and how broad-sweeping those studies were.
Yeah, sure. I think, thank you for calling, and thanks for your question, Kale. So I think the longitudinal studies that they've reported basically had four waves of data collection. So they were following kids from early childhood on until they were in middle childhood, and basically looking at what's happening in early childhood and how is that impacting behavior later on. And so basically what they found was that for parents reported that they were using repeated use of corporal punishment, so repeatedly spanking kids, which was a couple times a month is the way that the study defined this, that it basically over time, if you do it in early childhood when they're five, those children are more likely to have aggressive behavior, either with other children or with their parents. And then later on in school age, they're also at a risk to have increased in aggressive behavior. And later on, even later into middle childhood, they're at an increased risk for mental health disorders and cognitive problems. And so they followed these people or these children over a group of this cohort of children over a period of years. So the longitudinal study is really one of the most powerful methodologies to use when studying child development to really figure out how is what's happening early affecting the child as they develop and as they're older.
Amy Wagner is the executive director of the UW Child Development Lab. She stays with us as our conversation continues. How did your parents discipline you as a child? How do you discipline your children? Do you use techniques that aren't spanking or yelling? What are they? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. I'm John Munson. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Updated guidance from the American Academy of Pediatrics advises parents not to spank, yell at, or shame children. citing research that corporal punishment has been linked to negative outcomes. We're talking with a childhood development specialist about what to do as an alternative to corporal punishment and how corporal punishment affects children's health. How did your parents discipline you as a child, and how do you discipline your own children? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas at WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Amy Wagner is with us. She is the executive director of the UW Child Development Lab. What's our real goal here when we discipline our children? What is it we're trying to do?
Absolutely. So I feel like the goal is not just to get the child to follow the adult directions. What we're trying to do is get the child to internalize these kinds of behavioral rules and emotional regulation that we're hoping that they can then bring on to their lives as adults. So they're not waiting for someone to tell them what to do, or if that person is not in the room, they feel like they have free rein, but they actually are internally regulated both in their behavior and in their emotional expressions.
Let's take a call from Ray, who joins us from Milwaukee. Ray, good morning. Welcome to the morning show.
Good morning. When I was 4 years old, my cousins and I tried to burn down my cousin's house. And we sat in the house and did nothing while the house burned around us. The firemen had to break in the front door, this was on Milwaukee's east side, and save us from dying. When I got home, my father gave me a whipping. And I tell you, I never fooled around with fire again. And my stepson, when he was 3, decided to bolt out of his grandmother's house on Oakland Avenue. I don't know if you're familiar with Oakland Avenue on Milwaukee's east side. His mother gave him a spanking, I would say. There are some times when you have to use corporal punishment. I'm sorry, but whipping a child weekly for no reason is ridiculous. But in the 2 cases I just brought up, how would your best suggest we handle that? Because
okay,
I probably would have played with fire again.
All right, Ray, thanks. What about that? I mean, are there instances where the message just doesn't get home any other way?
I think that's a really good question, Ray. And I think that there is definitely a distinction between experiences where you as an adult have to respond fast and quickly and clearly in a way where there is no gray area for the child to know that this is something that is clearly not safe and must stop. So for example, a child, like you said, running into the street, like that is absolutely a time that the adult needs to respond in a way that is quick and fast and clear. Would I argue that spanking is the only answer in that situation? Absolutely not. I would say that if you're really working to help the child internalize these behaviors, you might, for example, really help the child see what happened. What happened when you burnt this, when you set this building on fire? What was the outcome of that? How could this have gone down? Like, wasn't that really scary? So those kinds of conversations, and I think seeing that burning building is super powerful, having to get saved by firefighters, that is super powerful. And so that having conversations about the emotional impact of that and how seeing the results of your behavior, seeing that could really impact your future choices, I think is another way to handle it. Do I agree that parents need to respond quickly in instances where children are at risk? Absolutely. Do I think spanking is the only way to do it? No, I don't. I think there's a lot better and more effective ways where the child is then not also scared and not feeling supported by their adult because the person that's supposed to be supporting them is now hitting them.
Let's talk to Sarah in Marshfield next. Sarah, good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so I have 2 children of my own, and I was spanked as a child, and my 2 younger siblings were also spanked. And there were multiple times where I remember feeling extremely frightened and confused. And I remember also feeling like I had to protect my brother and my sister from my mom. And, you know, I don't think that she was a horrible mother. I think they tried their best, but I would never spank my own kids now. Just, I don't want my kids to be afraid of me. I want them to understand clearly what it is that I'm trying to teach them, but I don't believe that spanking is the way for me to go about handling my own children. There are times that my mom kind of lost control and, you know, would hit us elsewhere, and, you know, sometimes we'd have to choose the spoon, and that's terrifying. And, you know, or you accidentally scratch. I have a scar on my hand because my mom accidentally scratched me with her fingernail, you know, and it's be there forever. So I
all right. Sarah, we get it. I want to get Amy's response, and then we have some other callers, too. Amy, what about Sarah's story, Amy?
Yeah, Sarah, I think your story is actually the experience of many children who have been spanked. And the attachment research basically says that this kind of abusive behavior can be very scary for the child, especially because that is the same person they're looking to for comfort and the same person who's supposed to help the child make sense of the world. And so if you're simultaneously afraid of and needing comfort from the same adult at the same time, you really put the child in a place where they're in conflict. And it's really confusing and difficult for children to figure that out and to maneuver that. And so I feel like your experience of being spanked is perhaps the kinds of experiences that other people have had, which is the reason why perhaps parents these days are less likely to spank than they were in the past.
Is there such a thing as a healthy fear of an adult?
Gosh, that's a really good question. I feel like in certain instances, yes. Like you want to not fear of the adult, but basically fear of certain situations. Like I know that if I step into the street, my parent will scream. I feel like that is something that you're just like, whoa, okay. Knowing the limits and knowing the adult is going to follow through with those limits is what you're after. But what you're not after is having the child be motivated by fear. Unless it's a situation of extreme danger, you really want the child to be motivated by, I'm trying to figure out how to regulate myself, control my emotions and control my behavior and internalize all of these societal expectations about how I'm supposed to behave as part of a group.
Let's hear from Sarah, who's joining us from Zion, Illinois. Sarah, good morning.
Hi.
Hi, Sarah.
Hi. I have argued about this a little bit with people. I'm a teacher, and most of my kids get spanked and hit, and it's something I always have to worry about when I make a phone call home as to what the consequence is going to be. And I searched online and I found this report from UNICEF actually about the corporal punishment, and it said that in addition to the things you're saying about it, it was said one consequence is that it in the child for their whole life they have an association between love and fear. Like they don't feel like they feel love unless they feel afraid of the person at the same time, and that goes on your whole life. And you know, I've heard that.
Let's get Amy's response here before we take a break. Amy, go ahead.
Yeah, and I feel like, again, these studies are basically showing the trends of what happens over time in a group of children. So is it guaranteed that every child who is spanked is going to associate love with fear later on? No, that's not it. But overall, the general trend is that this association is more likely to happen in children who were spanked than in children who weren't. And so it's not definitely going to happen, but it is more likely, and it puts children at risk for these kinds of conflicting behaviors.
Mike from Milwaukee wants to know how someone should punish a two-year-old who runs out into the street, because development of the brain when you're younger is still going on, and it's hard to stop them from doing things like that in other ways. We might have to hold the bulk of that response off for a few moments, but give us a quick hit on that idea.
Sure. I feel like in these situations, you need to respond fast and you need to do whatever you need to do to keep the child safe. But would I say spanking the child is the quickest, fastest way to save their life? No, absolutely not. It's getting them out of the street and sure. sending a clear verbal message to them that this can never happen again.
And you might that might involve physically picking the child up and removing them from the unsafe area.
Absolutely. That would be your first move. And I feel like mm-hmm. you need to be careful about how you pick a child up. But this is where I feel like you just do whatever you have to do to get them out of the street. But do I think that then you should immediately turn around and spank the child? No. But this is when you use a firm, strict voice, letting them know that this is absolutely not okay and cannot happen again. And this, like, they could die if they this happens again. Letting them know the consequences of this is why I'm going to take care of you and hold your hand and not let that happen to you.
Amy Wagner of the UW Child Development Lab stays with us as we talk about how updated guidelines suggest that we avoid corporal punishment as discipline for our children because of the adverse consequences it carries. What do you think? 800-642-1234. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Stay with us. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. We're talking about disciplining our children using healthy alternatives to more traditional forms of corporal punishment like spanking or yelling. New guidance from the American Academy of Pediatrics advises parents not to spank, yell at, or shame children, citing research that corporal punishment has been linked to negative outcomes. Do you spank your children or not? We want to hear from you about your thoughts on spanking and parenting. Or do you use some alternatives? We haven't heard too much about that yet this morning. We'd like to get your story. If you don't spank, what do you do and how has that worked? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Our guest today is Amy Wagner, Executive Director of the UW Child Development Lab. Amy, we've got more people who want to join us by phone. Let's start with Amy in Marinette. Amy, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Good morning, Amy.
I just had a quick question. I was wondering, I grew up, my parents were a little bit older when they had me. They were in their 30s, and I think that makes a difference. But when I was disciplined, you know, it was never in the heat of the moment, they're mad at me and I'm getting a spanking. It was more like, you're in trouble and there's going to be a punishment. And when it was spanking, it was calm. They discussed to me why, and I cried my eyes out, but it was more because I let them down than because it hurt. And I'm just wondering if that's considered different or if you're throwing that in with this negative effects pattern, because I never seem to have any issues from it. And I think the way that it was handled, I don't know that it falls into this generalization of what you're calling spanking. And can you clarify?
Yeah, sure, Amy. I think that's a good question. And so I feel like there's definitely different emotional tones when this kind of corporal punishment behavior occurs. And that is an important distinction. But what the research shows is basically parents usually typically escalate. So they try to talk to the child. They try other methods. And when that doesn't work, they tend to then use spanking as the last resort, which basically indicates it feels like the parents are out of other options. And so I feel like what we need to focus on is giving parents other more appropriate positive options, because in the reports that are in the research studies that were done, the same kinds of behaviors you're describing were in fact included in the definition of spanking. So even though it was in a more controlled, more maybe not as emotionally salient event than other spankings occur, it still fits in the operational definition of spanking in terms of the longitudinal studies and the studies done in terms of what spanking is doing in the immediate short term, which is also shown to not be as effective as stopping behavior in the short term.
Thanks for that phone call, Amy. I appreciate you joining us. The American Academy of Pediatrics also warned against all forms of what it called aversive punishments, including yelling and shaming. What is aversive discipline?
Yeah, so I basically think the way that they defined aversive discipline is discipline that comes from a place of negativity. So basically, you do this, I will hit you, or you do this, and I will make you feel this way about yourself. And so I feel like the difference between aversive discipline and positive discipline is really thinking about, can I foster good behavior and good social emotional self-regulation skills in my children, or am I going to tell them that they're bad and this is wrong, and make them feel a certain negative way about their behavior instead of realizing, like, okay, I made a mistake, but there are other more positive options I can choose. I'm not a bad kid. I just made a bad decision.
How old are children? Do children have to be before they can really understand that kind of logic?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I would say that even as early as 18 months, children would be able to understand that, you know, we as parents really care about, or as teachers, we really care about you. It's just this behavior that we don't like. And so I feel like they themselves might not be able to verbally express that back to you and, like, explain that they understand. But because of the behavior I've seen over 20 years in working with programs where, frankly, this kind of corporal punishment and verbal abuse is just not even an option on the table, the teachers I work with, we all have to figure out more positive, appropriate ways to help foster positive development and positive self-regulation. And we've seen that these methods can work, and they do work. And in fact, if you look at the research that's been talked about in the AAP report, they are associated later on in life with less incidence of mental health issues, cognitive delays. They've even found a connection in MRI studies that there are differences in brains of people who have experienced this regular spanking. And another study that shows even if a person has not been spanked, has just received verbal abuse with this kind of shaming, there's also differences in MRI. There's less white matter in their brains. And so even verbal abuse, the shaming kind of discipline, can have an impact on the architecture of a person's brain when they grow up.
Let's take another call. Kalina joins us from Milwaukee. Kalina, good morning.
Good morning. You guys were talking about alternative methods of discipline versus punishment. And last year I had an opportunity to take a class of love and logic through my son's school. Mm-hmm. And it just opened the doors to understanding how much our own behavior, like, directs your child's behavior, and to recenter ourselves to understand that if we are calm, we can relay what we need to through our kid. And so often we allow ourselves to get so emotional that we can't react in a disciplinary manner. We react punishing, which is the yelling and the striking and the abrupt just response.
Absolutely.
And one of the biggest things that is part of that love and logic is basically letting your child live out a safe consequence. So if they choose to not brush their teeth, okay, no dessert, and following through with that. And then they realize, oh, if I want to have a dessert, I got to brush my teeth.
Right.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so Kalina, I think there are many programs out there for parents who are looking for other alternatives to this corporal punishment and more shaming option that we might have been raised with. And I think that there are love and logic is a great example of really thinking about how the parent's emotional state sets the tone for then the child's emotional state. So if you as a parent are feeling out of control and lose it, what you're doing is basically modeling the absence of self-regulation for your child. You're telling them it's okay when you're feeling angry or scared to lash out or yell at another child or hit someone, in fact. And so really starting from the parent, there's this great book called Parenting from the Inside Out by Daniel Siegel, who's one of the cutting edge researchers in terms of brain development. He finally stopped doing his research to write this parenting book to say, hey, look, parents, we need to take a look at what's going on deep inside ourselves so that we can regulate ourselves in order to model this kind of self-regulation in our kids so they're not then losing control either, and that they see there's a different option of how we can relate to one another.
I think Kelly in Cascade has a comment that will help our conversation here. Kelly, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Great topic. So I have two daughters, 7 and 10, and I have definitely had moments where I am feel like I'm losing it.
Absolutely. All parents do.
Yeah, and it threw me off guard because I had parents a little bit older, and I was like, oh my goodness, there's nothing that hits my buttons more than this. And I have, somewhere along the way, I learned to, rather than giving my kids a timeout, because sometimes they really don't get why they're getting a timeout, so I've realized that I need to take a timeout. And so if I'm ready to lose it, I'll say, I'm going to go take some space for myself. I'm going to take a timeout. And their eyebrows raise. And then I go take some space, breathe, let off some steam, and then come back. And then I'm definitely able to engage and really let them know what was going on and where either of us kind of got out of line.
Kelly, thanks so much for sharing that with us. Amy, what do you think of what Kelly had to say?
Congratulations, Kelly. I feel like it's very brave to know as a parent when you're feeling out of control and to be able to recognize that and show your children that you're vulnerable to having these really big, overwhelming emotional experiences too, but then modeling the skills of being able to say, okay, I recognize this is how I feel. This is what I need to do in order to help myself feel better so that I can come back to this interaction in a way that's beneficial for both of us. I think that's the perfect kind of modeling of positive self-regulation skills that we want to be doing with our kids. I have done this. I was working with a toddler with autism, and she had really been pushing my buttons. And I finally said, I need a timeout. And I just went and took a break. And she looked at me like, whoa, wait, like you need this too? And after that, when I did need to put her in timeout for whatever reason, it felt like she understood this isn't a punishment. This is a way to help me really help myself calm down. And if you're in that timeout with the child, not just leaving them alone, but saying, you need a timeout, let's take a break. I'm here if you need me to help you calm down. That is the most supportive type of timeout, is really to focus on changing the emotional tone and giving the child support to change that emotional tone. Because when they're so young or maybe dealing with developmental delays or disabilities, learning to calm yourself down is actually a huge skill. And the way you do that first, they call it self-regulation, but the first way you do it is by through help from others. And so it's self-regulation through help from others at the beginning. So Kelly, that is exactly the kind of parenting that is really modeling, labeling emotions, helping a child self-regulate, and really figuring out that all of us need help with this, and like the adults and the children together.
Amy Wagner is the executive director of the UW Child Development Lab. Amy, thank you so much for spending this time with us this morning.
Absolutely. Happy to be here.
Coming up next on The Morning Show, we talk about hemp farming. It is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. It's been about 50 years since Wisconsin farmers could legally grow hemp. Governor Walker lifted the ban last year, and since then, interest in hemp farming has been intense. One reason is that hemp is a source of CBD, which is a valuable commodity. The hemp industry is just getting going, but supporters see lots of growth potential. Rick Rommel is a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He covers general business news and retail and joins us to talk about hemp farming in Wisconsin. So, Rick, welcome to the program. Thanks for being here today.
Glad to be here. How are you doing, John?
Pretty good so far, but the day is young. Hemp farming legal in Wisconsin since late last year. Can anyone farm this crop, or does the law place restrictions on who can actually grow hemp?
It does. You have to have a license, and the license is issued by the State Department of Agriculture. They issued, I think, something like 240 licenses for 2018, and about 140 people actually planted crops.
So what are the qualifications you have to have in order to get one of these licenses?
I don't. Sorry, I'm not too familiar with the licensing requirements. I don't think there's anything in particular
the state just wants to know who's doing it.
Basically, yeah.
Okay.
And one interesting aspect of the law is that the license holders are not made public. So I, as a reporter, can't ask, well, I could ask, and I did, the Agriculture Department for a list of licensees, but the law specifically says that that'll be confidential. And that is an issue for some of the growers, because they, and some of the processors, they'd like to know who are the potential suppliers of hemp. So there are some, at least there's talk of allowing people to make themselves public, so that they can be known in the industry.
What's the purpose for having this be an anonymous activity? Do you know?
I'm not sure. I think it was that they felt that people would be, perhaps, I don't know, embarrassed because they're growing something that's
really
associated in the many people's minds with marijuana.
Good heavens, it's 2018. Okay, well, let's move on from that. We don't want to get too far into the weeds here. How much interest have we seen since hemp farming became legal last year?
Well, this is a very small business, no matter how you slice it. But the response in Wisconsin was quite robust. Many more people applying for licenses and actually growing than did so in the first year of legalized hemp farming in Minnesota, and even in states such as Washington and Colorado, I believe, at the beginning, their activity was less than what we've seen in Wisconsin.
Are most of the growers you've spoken with farming hemp for the CBD or for other purposes?
When I wrote this story, I was really concentrating on CBD. There are a lot of other reasons to grow hemp, and there are some farmers who are doing that or who plan to. I mean, it can be a grain crop. You can process hemp oil, which is not CBD, but some people think it has beneficial effects. So I talked to a couple people who were growing for that purpose, but I deliberately focused on people who were interested in the CBD market.
And, of course, people have long talked about the utility of the hemp plant and all the other things that can be done with it. But CBD is just a really hot topic right now. We're talking with Rick Rommel, reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, covering general business news and retail, about hemp farming and what the situation here is in Wisconsin since it was made legal last year. Zeroing in on CBD, how lucrative can this business be for individual farms?
Well, the numbers that people see are pretty seductive, at least in terms of revenue, because a gram of CBD oil at retail could bring anywhere from, say, $50 to $120, one gram. And people are selling it in bottles in milligrams, measured in milligrams for the most part. So, for example, I talked with these young guys who are setting up a processing plant in Sussex, and they extract the CBD from the hemp flowers and then distill it further, so they get a product that's kind of like a raw sort of crude oil type of thing with a heavy concentration of CBD in it, and 200 grams in a little jar that you could hold in the palm of your hand, worth $10,000 to $20,000 at retail.
I mean, forgive me, but this starts to sound like stepping on heroin in order to sell it on the street. But I know that's probably a really bad comparison. So what has this looked like at the retail level in Wisconsin?
There have been all kinds of stores that have popped up. There are probably at least 20, I would say, stores this year in Wisconsin. I expect there will be quite a few more. I've heard of additional ones since I wrote the article. This former alderman in Milwaukee started selling it last June. Very soon after that, had a little kiosk at Mayfair Mall. Graduated to a full-fledged store, opened kiosks in three or four other malls in the state. And when I visited his shop at Mayfair, there were a lot of, this was on a late morning, weekday morning, a lot of people coming in. Seemed like there was considerable interest in it.
Let's take a call from William in Delavan. William, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I just feel this is a deja vu with, you know, the corn industry. This is a monoculture that is bad for the environment. It's an annual. So if Wisconsin wants to position itself as an agricultural leader in this new field, or it should probably focus on the fabric or fiber as a source of revenue for hemp, because China has basically the apparel industry and the shoe industry. So if we want to reduce the carbon footprint of our country, it would be best for making things local. And I'll take
your answer. William, thanks for that. So talk to us about some of the other products that can be made from hemp, Rick.
You know, John, I'm sorry. I'm fairly knowledgeable about CBD. I didn't set out to write about hemp farming overall. So I can tell you what you want to know about CBD, but
Got it. 100 years ago, Wisconsin was one of the country's largest hemp producers. Do you think we'll return to that status now that growing is legal again?
I don't know. I mean, we're behind in the legalization of hemp, and this is all being done under a temporary program a temporary program that was authorized in the 2014 Farm Bill. Kentucky has been doing this for a few years. Colorado is fairly large in it. I guess Wisconsin does have a good climate for growing hemp, so perhaps, but who knows?
So there is some potential for growth in the industry because it is in its infancy, and when you're starting from zero, 10 seems like a jump. There is a future for hemp in Wisconsin, and we do have room to grow. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. I mean, the crop, especially if you're growing for CBD, you don't need a lot of land. In fact, it's more well suited to small patches,
like a garden,
almost like a garden, because it was described to me as being similar in the demands that it makes on the grower to ginseng or tobacco. I mean, we never had 1,000-acre tobacco fields here. We had 20 acres of tobacco. That's what you're likely to see with this.
Rick Rommel, thanks for joining us this morning. I appreciate your time.
Sounds good. Thanks, John.
Rick Rommel, reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, covering general business news and retail. I'm John Munson. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.